You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome. It is Monday, April 5th, and welcome to Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning. What a beautiful weekend we had.
It is a beautiful weekend, and you know the air here is fabulous, and we were just trying to figure out how the helicopter on Mars works without that in that Martian atmosphere, but it wouldn't have any trouble working here in Park City.
That is true. That is true, though it might have other challenges. We will wait and see. Probably a topic for another show, though, Roger.
It is. But as far as our show, this morning we have the co-founders of the Remote Leadership Institute, Kevin Eikenberry and Wayne Termel, to talk about their book, The Long Distance Teammate, Stay Engaged and Connected While Working Anywhere. This new book provides a roadmap for individuals, allowing them to take ownership of their own engagement to their work and relieving the stress and frustrations that can come from remote working.
And our second guest is going to be a topic that many in Park City have a keen interest in. We're going to have Serial One Cycle Company. They're a dedicated e-bicycle brand formed in partnership with the iconic American motorcycle manufacturer Harley-Davidson. They recently announced the establishment of its Western U.S. headquarters right here in Lehi, Utah. Brandon Proctor with Serial One Cycle Company is going to join us this morning and talk about that. And then we're going to end the hour talking with Stephanie Reese. Stephanie will share the path she took after graduating Park City High to find her passion as a marine scientist. All this and more today on Mountain Money.
Over the last year, many of those new to working remotely have figured out how to get their work done at home. But there's a real difference between being a remote worker and being an effective member of a remote team. We have to learn how to operate remotely and learn how to be a great teammate while working apart from those with whom we collaborate, especially since virtual organizations are now ubiquitous and in many cases here to stay. Even before the pandemic, remote work was growing at nearly 30% per year. In their new book, The Long Distance Teammate, Stay Engaged and Connected While Working Anywhere, co-founders of the Remote Leadership Institute, Kevin Eikenberry and Wayne Termel, offer readers at all levels of an organization clear and compelling advice for moving from team members to teammates. Welcome to Mountain Money. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin. Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Wayne. Well, let's start by talking about the big picture. How significant is the move toward remote working, and do you think it's here to stay?
Well, it's funny that you said something. This is Wayne, obviously. It's funny that you kind of Freudian slipped learning and working because they're part of the same process. You know, if you talk to your kids, you know that they live online and, you know, the days of sending them out back and coming in before the streetlights come on are pretty much over. And it's the same kind of sea change that's happened with work. And so it's definitely in some form here to stay. Whether it's going to look the same as it has for the past year is unlikely, but the genie is definitely out of the bottle.
So talk to us about your Leadership Institute. You've obviously been doing this remotely. You've obviously been helping people work remotely for a while. In the past, what has been the biggest challenge for people once they get approval from their boss to work remotely, and how has that maybe changed in today's world?
Well, I think for many people, before it was either considered a perk, right, or they maybe, as you said, got permission to do that. I'm getting some feedback here. Sorry about that. But they got permission, and the reality was it wasn't everybody, and it wasn't mandated. And so I think all of those things changed it a lot from where it was to what it became over the last 12 months. And so earlier it was often by choice or by hoping to have that. And of course now everyone had to go. And I think what's happened now is people have figured out, both organizations and individuals, that this is viable to work remotely. Whether that's where we stay for everybody all the time, I think, is definitely in question. But we definitely are past the point of people wondering if it's possible, because now you don't have to look very hard to see that it's possible.
You know,
and I think one of the other things that's really fundamentally changed is remote work was being driven by the individual, and a lot of senior leaders were reluctant because they've never lived in that world, they've never done it. Now they've done it themselves, and they're seeing the possibilities for recruitment and hiring and retention and all of those things. So it used to be, if you said, hey, I want to work from home, you were basically making the decision that lifestyle mattered more than career track. And a lot of organizations are going to have to find a way to reexamine that.
In the introduction, you touch on three key words. You talk about the three key words of what you're trying to communicate in the book. And those words were teammate, connected, and engaged. And I think when we start talking about the challenges of working remotely, and I know I started working remotely almost 15 years ago, and one of the big things that was tricky was the teamwork piece. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, let me take that, and I'll let Wayne take the other two. So the thing is that most people, especially as they work from home, their focus becomes very insular, and they think that their job equals their work. But really, your job equals your work plus the team's work. And as leaders, we have to help team members see their role more broadly. And if you're working from home, our challenge to you is to say, to think about your work, not as your task list, but as how do I be a team member? How do I engage with those others that I work with? And how do I make sure that I see my job as more than just the stuff on my personal task list?
And what are some piece of advice you have for people to stay more engaged with their team?
Well, I think for a lot of us, the big thing about staying engaged is we need to care, right? We need to care about our job, our organization, and we need to care about the people that we work with. Why would I make the extra effort to reach out to Bob? You know, in the old days, we could just shout across the cube farm and it was all good. It takes more work for me to reach out to Bob. Why would I do that if I don't have a solid connection to our work and a passion for it? Why would I do that if I don't care about Bob? Right.
Add to that, before I just happened to see Bob, so it was easier to just, you know, the accidental interaction, right? And now I have to be intentional about doing that. And that's a whole nother level of caring and a whole nother level of being proactive.
And the thing about engagement, this is really important for a lot of organizations to understand, because people think that engagement is something organizations do, right? If we have enough pizza parties, if we have enough Zoom meetings, people will engage. But in fact, engagement is driven by the individual, right? The analogy that I've been using for a while is you can buy somebody flowers, you can take them on dates, you can buy the ring, you can get down on one knee, but you're not engaged until the other person says yes. And it's the same with work. One of the big pitfalls of remote work, as Kevin said, is there's a tendency to get very isolated and concentrate only on your work. And so if we're not intentionally engaging, if we're not intentionally building relationships with our organization and our teammates, it's really easy for that to disintegrate, and nothing good happens when people don't care anymore.
Another interesting aspect of working remotely is the maintenance of productivity. In the book, you talk about something called the 3P model. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it works?
Well, we did a lot of talking to both our own folks and customers and people out in the world about what makes a great teammate. One of the things that we're very clear about in the book is there's a difference between being somebody on a team, right? Somebody who has the same boss as everybody else, and being a real teammate, you know, that there was an emotional engagement level that was higher. And what made the difference? And we found that the three P's, productivity, proactivity, and potential, made that up. And a lot of us focus first and foremost on productivity, because that's the obvious marker. If you don't get your work done, you're not going to have a job very long. But productivity is more than just getting tasks checked off the list. The thing about productivity is it's getting the right work done in the right way at the right time to get the right results for the team.
So let me switch gears here a little bit. We're at an inflection point, a really wonderful inflection point for the country, right? We've got about a third of adults now vaccinated, at least one shot. And so I find myself sitting in the studio now with my two peers here, much more relaxed than I have been for a year. I mean, it's just a wonderful feeling. And some people are going to say, you know, I want to go back to the office. Other people are going to say, you know, I want to keep working remotely. And from a business standpoint, how do you think about the hybrid situation? In some ways, it may have been easier for all of us to be remotely than maybe half the team remote and half the team in the office.
Well, I don't think in some ways. I think in most ways, right? The reality is that hybrid is another level of complexity beyond either everyone in or everyone out. And the other thing that makes hybrid models so challenging is there's not just one version, right? Everybody's version of what hybrid's going to look like is going to be different. And that thing's going to cause a whole lot of challenges for organizations. And it starts with the organization, the leadership, thinking about our work, our culture, what do we really want? And what do we really want for our teams moving forward? That's going to be where the challenge is. Our comment is as much about how we make the decision about where we end up as the decision we make itself.
So give us some thoughts on how to make that decision. What are some ways to be more likely to be successful with your organization with that decision?
Well, in the short version of talking about this on the radio, I would say to senior leaders, you have got to engage your folks in that decision. That decision is a business decision, and it's a team member, teammate decision. So the more you can engage other people in the organization in the thinking about it and in the decisions about it and creating the criteria for it, the better chance you'll have of success.
Yeah, it's really easy for this to become a kind of top-level financial decision, right? There are organizations we work with that are in the process of shrinking their real estate footprint, for example, because they don't need space because people aren't coming into the office. But then what do you do when you do want to get everybody together? You know, people are going to want to come back. They're expecting to come back to their desk. Well, their desk is gone, right? They're now being told that they need to come into the office and they need to hotel and share a desk with whoever's in on Tuesday. And that's going to cause a little more trauma and drama than people think. So the sooner you engage everyone in the discussion, the less people are likely to burn up on reentry.
Going back to sort of your tips for when people are still working remotely, one of the things you talk about is the importance of routine. I know that when I was first starting to work remotely, I found that if I got out of bed, went to Starbucks, and came back and was then, quote, at the office, end quote, that routine helped me define the difference between my work life and my home life. Talk a little bit about routines and how they matter.
That's a really good example. And a really good process, actually, because we had some start of day routines automatically before, right? It included getting in our car, getting on mass transit, what bus, whatever it is. And now, for the most part, the commute is down the hall, right? So determining what that routine is going to be for yourself is important. I've been asking people for months this question: what have you been doing with the time you used to spend commuting? And the average American before the pandemic had a 27-minute commute each way. So I've been asking people, how have you spent that extra hour? And some people have said, well, I've spent it sleeping. And some people have said, I've spent it reading. And some people have said, I spent it meditating, prayer, thinking. Some people have said, I've been exercising. Some people have said, I've been working. And the line between work and home is further blurred.
Yeah, that's
a serious problem. So Yeah, go ahead.
I think to your point, Kevin, if and I'm sorry to interrupt, I think to your point, a lot of those people who said they've been doing those things are not being entirely honest either. They may be doing those things, but almost all of them are waking up, reaching over, grabbing their phone, and engaging with their email and their messages and all of that before they literally have the ground under their feet.
So,
and I think our point would be, I'm sorry, our point would be, you need to have the routines, and you now have them after a year, but the question is, are they serving you? Like, you have a new routine now. Question is it serving you best, both for yourself, well, I guess for yourself, for your life, and for your work? And so at this point, the time is to think about, okay, is this really working for me? Do I need to make some adjustments to it instead of just doing what I came to, right, when I no longer had to go get in my car?
I want to circle back to one of the comments you made earlier at the start of the interview, which was one of the hesitancies earlier with people working remotely is their bosses, senior management had never done that, and so they had doubts, how's this going to work? I think one of the surprises for many of us, I think one of the fears was people would not fully engage, would not work as hard from home. And the reports I'm seeing, you guys are the experts, I'm just seeing this anecdotally, but what I'm seeing is people are actually working more. The challenge is getting people to unplug at the end of the day. Does your research show that? And what advice do you have for people to unplug at the end of the day? Because it's really important to have that line of separation that we were talking about, that the car ride home from work used to give you.
Well, if I can talk about the data, and then Kevin can talk about the specifics. You're absolutely right, and it's more than anecdotal evidence. One of the things we found, the world has found, is that in the second quarter of last year, when we started working from home, employee engagement scores actually went up. And remember, employee engagement scores measure how much people care, how much effort they're giving, how hard they're trying. And senior executives were kind of surprised by this, but we weren't particularly, because we know when there's a crisis, people pull together and they give more effort, and they do. The problem is that we all thought this was going to be over by Memorial Day of last year. And so that level of engagement, of not turning off, of putting in extra hours over time is unsustainable. You can do it for a short period of time while the crisis is fresh, but over time it starts to wear on you. And so maintaining that engagement over a long period of time, part of the reason that productivity maintained its status is because people are really good at getting stuff done when they're not interrupted, but we were also working longer hours. We were, from the moment we rolled out of bed till the moment we rolled back in, connected all the time, and eventually that's unsustainable. We have to develop, because there isn't the artificial structure of the commute and the office door opening and kicking us out at night, we've had to create our own structure, and not everybody's great at that.
What do people need to do? And give us some very tactical things that you can do. You need to put more, you need to have a conversation with those that you're living with about creating some boundaries and expectations. You need to have some clear boundaries and expectations with those that you work with. And so, first of all, if you're a leader and you're doing what Wayne just described and you're sending emails late at night, I guarantee you your team is checking their email late at night. So if you're a leader, you can be helping your entire team with this by changing your approach. But for all of us, we've got to put more friction so that we make between the technology and the work and our line of sight and our effort. So for example, make sure the laptop is closed. Make sure that you hide the laptop in another room if you can, right? Cover it up with a blanket if it's on your dining room table. Do anything that says, now if I take off the blanket, open it up and log in. All of those things are conscious decisions, and they're more likely that you won't make them. But if every ding is showing up on every notification is showing up on every device, it's much harder to not just pick up the phone or flip open the laptop. So come to some agreements with your family and your organization about when and what that's going to look like. And then just be as intentional as you can about it, including putting more friction between you and opening it back up or starting working again.
The flip side of creating clear boundaries around work is the importance of creating and facilitating relationships. You talked about this a little earlier in our conversation, the fact that you're going to bump into someone at the coffee shop. You're going to hear about what's going on with their children. You're going to create something that enables the later conversations on a work structure to have an underlying support. Talk a little bit about how we build and maintain relationships in a remote world.
Well, the first thing I think is we need to be aware of the power of those relationships. You know, one of the three P's that we were talking about is potential, that we need to think about the long-term impact of our communication. And one of the things that happens when we work remotely is communication becomes very transactional. It's all about, I want to do what I need to do, get the answer to my question, and move on. A lot of us have started conversations with, I know you're busy, so let's get down to it. And where before we would unconsciously take the time to say, hey, how are the kids? Sorry about your team last week. You know, those conversations, now we need to do them on purpose and be mindful of, are we communicating in a way that builds the relationships? You know, I can get on Kevin's case because he owes me a report, and I can be really snippy about it and get the report, but down the road, what's that going to do to my relationship with Kevin?
Well, it's one of the
mindfulness.
Another way we like to think about that is that we're still going to have the transaction. We're still going to transact the business. What we need to make sure we continue to have is the interaction between each other. And so make sure that we're putting that on the front end of the conversation. Because if we wait till the end of the phone call, we won't have time. We'll move on to the next thing.
So we've got
one of the things that we're finding is that teams that were intact before they went remote are maintaining the relationships that existed. The real challenge is with the new hires and the people who didn't have that relationship when all of this went down.
That's exactly where I wanted to go, which is I'm fortunate. Most people I work with at my company, I've worked with for at least a decade. I've been at my company 20 years. People stay at my company a long time. But what advice do you have for that new employee to get that visibility that's so important in the first 3-6 months of your career at that company?
Well, Kevin's the guy to ask because he actually has a process with every new hire that joins our company. So I'm just going to lob that grenade into his lap.
Well, I have a clear expectation when people join our team, and our team is remote and has been for many, many years. Someone joins the team, they have an expectation in the first 2 weeks that they have a 30-minute, hopefully Zoom or webcam conversation with everybody else on the team that doesn't talk about work. So now, if you're a new employee in an organization, you probably or you may not have a boss that's told you that, but my encouragement to you is this. Take the time to reach out to your new fellow teammates to just get to know them. You know, hey, can we have 10 minutes of coffee and just chat about, get to know each other a little bit? And most everyone's going to say, sure, find a time that works for them and do that. Because if we don't do it intentionally, it may never happen.
Well, on that note, gentlemen, we need to wrap up. Fascinating and timely discussion. Thank you for your work. We've been speaking with the authors of the book, The Long Distance Teammate, Stay Engaged and Connected While Working Anywhere. Gentlemen, thank you for your time this morning.
Serial One Cycle Company is a dedicated e-bicycle brand formed in partnership with the iconic American motorcycle manufacturer, Harley-Davidson. Serial One recently announced the establishment of its Western U.S. headquarters here in Utah, in Lehi. Taking its name from Serial Number One, the nickname for Harley-Davidson's first motorcycle, Serial One Cycle Company combines Harley-Davidson's world-class product development capability and leadership in two-wheel electric propulsion with the agility and innovation of a startup brand dedicated exclusively to the e-bicycle product and customer. Here to discuss e-bicycle industry topics and trends is Serial One Cycle Company Vice President of Sales and Service and a brand new Utah resident, Brandon Proctor. Brandon, good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Glad to talk with y'all.
Well, this is pretty exciting. When I was 17 years old, I got my first 50cc Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Hard to believe they were that small. And now we're coming out with something that's even smaller in a sense. Give us a little bit of the history of Serial One Cycle Company and its partnership with Harley-Davidson.
Sure. I think what's interesting is Serial One was really born out of an initiative within Harley called More Roads. And I think at its core, the design there was to expand that customer base and to tap into new areas of mobility. And really, that's what e-bikes are. It's a kind of a reinvention of mobility at its true form.
And talk about the partnership with Harley. It sounds like it was a spin out from Harley as opposed to a company pursuing Harley for a partnership. But take us behind the scenes. How did your company come to be?
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, I think what a lot of people may not be aware of is this has been a business and a product line that's years in the making. Traditionally, you know, bicycles from the idea, from the forming of the idea to when they actually generate and move the products out into the market is anywhere between 3 and 4 years of a life cycle to get there. And so this was truly formed within Harley. The business, it has been spun out, and Serial One is its own brand. But Harley continues to maintain a minority investment in the business, although you'll notice that our teams are both in two spots. We still have our product team and engineering out at the Milwaukee campus, out where everyone knows Harley's headquarters is at. And then what we've established is an additional Western office here that's handling everything from customer interaction and support and sales. And so truly, this is a brand born in Harley's DNA and rooted in that. And I think you can see it certainly if you look at the silhouette of the bikes and compare them to that original Serial One model that you mentioned earlier from 1903. If you put those side by side, you can kind of see that it's no mistake that those are meant to show the DNA of Harley and where it came from.
I want to talk a little bit about your product lines, but first, you've mentioned the product development is in sales are at the two locations you mentioned. Where's manufacturing going to be?
So we've got partners globally and all over the world, and so we try to bring the best of all technologies. You know, we've got German motors and Italian hubs for those CVT systems, and TRP using a great domestic U.S. Manufacturer for the braking system. So really a combination of all sorts.
And final assembly will be where?
We've got an offshore partner that helps out and is by far the most, you know, a premium in their segment.
So talk to us. I think one of the you know, e-bikes are obviously becoming very popular. I don't know the numbers, but I'd be surprised if they're not one of the top two or three categories in the cycling space right now. And there's a bunch of names out there that many of us have not heard of, right? Harley-Davidson, huge advantage there. Is it backed the warranty and the support? And if I need to replace out one of those hubs, is that backed by the full faith of Harley, or is that fully on the backs of your company as a sole entity?
Well, Serial One again is its own brand, but again, the backing and the technology and where this is coming from a product side is certainly founded, rooted, and backed from its roots at Harley, and so. What I would say is most importantly, if I'm a customer out there interested in this product, it certainly meets and exceeds warranty expectations, right? There's, you know, 5 years on the frame, you know, 2 years on the batteries and the drivetrain on that. And what we would expect is a customer should feel confident that we can handle them. In fact, my team personally is the one that they'd be interacting with. And we're certainly happy to ensure that there's both strong product support and great interaction. If they needed something replaced, and we've got a variety of mechanisms out there, right? Certainly, we want to give them access to get a hold of us directly, and they'd be able to email and contact our team to kind of get the ball rolling and help assess if there was an issue. Although what I would say is more importantly, our design is meant to be one that's very intuitive and simplistic and meant to be very low maintenance in the parts and pieces we put on there.
Tell us a little bit about the product line. What range of bicycle products are you offering and at this point? And also, of course, where are you in terms of dealer development?
Yeah, so the range is meant to hit on kind of those differing customer segments, right? We do bikes in a couple of categories. So our bikes fall into something that's called Class 1 and Class 3 categorization. And for your average everyday person hearing that, it means maybe nothing. But I think it's important to note it has a lot to do with regulations and speed. And so three of our four models are what fall into a class one category, which has a max assist up to 20 miles an hour, which frankly for many is plenty and extremely enjoyable. We also have a class three bike that goes up to 28 miles an hour for the pedal assist. What they are not, I think one thing that's important to note is throttled bikes. I think many people may assume because it's got a Harley lineage that there's a throttle like a motorcycle, but the class one and class three bikes are able to be utilized in basically anywhere that a bicycle can be used. And that was really core and critical to us launching. So, you know, we have a range that fits both those class one and class three options, but we also offer kind of differing technologies. And really some of the key differences there are the single speed style, which is meant to be kind of more recreational and fun-based. And we also have our CVT transmission hubs from Enviola we use on our other three models. Those are meant to provide more of a seamless style of riding, and it automatically shifts the gears much like a car. And people are often pretty intrigued by that once they ride them.
So Tom, just going to say there is right now many communities around America are dealing with how do we regulate these bicycles, these electric bicycles? Are they allowed on our trails? Are they not? I, for one, am grateful for the electric bike movement. I'm personally an electric skateboard person, and it's opened the doors to where electric skateboards are allowed to go, and it started the conversation. Give our audience an update. What's happening from a regulation standpoint? Like in a town like Park City, can you ride a Class 3 electric bike on virtually any road and trail, or how should people be thinking about where they can ride these?
Sure. You know, if you had asked me 5 years ago, the answer would have been much different. There was a significant difference in the regulation and acceptance of these. And many groups and states have really partnered together to ensure that these are better understood by the riders and the community. And that's really opened a lot of doors. And at this point, you're seeing trails across America now understanding these are no longer classified as motorcycles, which many, I think, originally thought they were. And they're starting to understand that they don't have this perceived impact on the environment or society. And again, keeping in mind, our models and our line is very focused on kind of trail or paved trail and road use. We don't have per se a mountain model for dirt trails, but certainly would say that over the last 5 years, you've seen an acceptance across the country. You've seen a quote unquote, you know, deregulation of where they can and can't go. And at this point, you know, these bicycles would go anywhere that a bicycle could be ridden as kind of a standard traditional bicycle.
Talk to us a little bit about your distribution model. I wanted to hear about, are you using dedicated dealers? Are you going to retail through multiple outlets? And how will that interface with sort of warranty and service issues?
Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to both partner with the Harley-Davidson dealers that are participating across the U.S. And certainly know that they'll have a great experience going in there. But also realize that there's a need across parts of the country as well as Europe where we're at over in Germany. Where consumers can access SerialOne.com and see and inform themselves about the product line, and if they're excited enough, certainly can buy right then and there.
So, are you anticipating your principal distribution will be through Harley-Davidson dealers here in the States?
It is from a physical channel, and that was purposeful. We know that some people are going to need to test and try. Whereas others will certainly be comfortable with buying and the ease of buying directly online. And so we want to make sure that both experiences exist. And so what they can do in that setup is join them at the Harley-Davidson dealerships and go in for a test ride, see the models, try them, and if needed, you know, test the different sizes and place that order, you know, right then and there. So that is the primary distribution model, and that allows us to meet kind of both sides of the consumer's needs.
Well, that's exciting on many fronts. I don't have an excuse to go into a Harley Davidson dealership very often, although I think it would be fun to do so. I wonder if I'll feel like Pee Wee Herman going in trying out the electric bikes. with all those big Harleys there as well. I just say that in jest. So that's really, frankly, a little exciting that it's going to be sold through the Harley-Davidson dealerships as well as online. My question is, when the whole pandemic started a year ago, I've been following the e-bike movement for a while, and I know there were like six-month waits almost immediately after the pandemic started to get an e-bike. What's the price point of your bike, and what's the current wait time to get one?
Yeah, the price points go from the low threes up to just under $5,000, and that's across the four models. And you would not be incorrect in your assessment on that. I have friends in different states that are still on some of those 6 and 7 month wait lists. And I think what's exciting for us is our timing is a bit special for us in that we will have inventory, and it is already currently starting to ship out. And so, you know, consumers could see weeks of a wait at this point. We've sold out a few of the first couple of waves, which has been exciting for us, of course. And customers at this point, you know, we were at an event last month where people were placing orders, and we were expecting to see those out in the next 4 to 5 weeks, shipping directly to their door or to the dealership of their choice. So the benefit certainly for us is that we have inventory and will have inventory. And have a great premium product to offer. So between those two, I think we certainly expect to do well as the spring kicks off.
And just out of curiosity, the Harley pedigree is obviously critical to part of your identification. Does it carry all the way to your design and color scheme? In other words, are these bikes going to be like orange and black?
You know, there's roots of that in there. We certainly have colors that have some of those Harley Davidson nods. And we know that some people that's going to be important. And we do have colors offered in that. But at the same time, one of the things that you'll notice is there's a classy, kind of simple design to the style here, and the colors we try to match with that. So we certainly have different color options and have two for each one, and that allows consumers to decide which one is really the fit for them. But as far as overt, you know, Harley-Davidson colors or branding, I mean, I think we'll evolve and to see what the consumers want, but also want to have a classy option to begin.
And of course, anyone listening to this, because this is radio, is going to want to say, wonder what those look like. Let's take a quick detour and tell us about where I can see these on the web.
Sure. Fairly simple. Serial1.com. Serial, the number 1.com would immediately put you on the website. And up in the top left corner, it's got our e-bicycle products. You can just simply click down on that and start to kind of run through the models. Each one will show you high-res, large images from a bunch of different angles, each of the colors, and then, of course, the specs underneath that you could answer all of your detailed questions that you might want to know.
And are there any dealerships in the Salt Lake City or Provo area where people can see them in display?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we have a few in the area, and I was just down the street at one a couple of weeks ago at Tippenogo's Harley to kind of look into the products they had in there, and you'll see the setup. So really, if you head over there, you definitely could check those out. It works out nicely. There's a great Sliders restaurant next door, so you can make a bit of a lunch out of it as well.
Talk a little bit about how Serial One ended in Utah. Well, what drove your decision? You know, as a Utah business show, we're always interested in why and how businesses come here.
Yeah, I mean, for those outside of the Salt Lake area or just Utah in general, I think one of the things they may not know is there's a fairly large outdoor contingent of businesses in the Salt Lake area, and that certainly was part of the decision as to what brought us here. You've also got proximity to the West Coast, which is certainly nice for logistics. And in addition to all that, I mean, you've got a combination of good cost of living in the Utah area. You've got a good, labor base to hopefully pull great talent from. And let's be honest, why do a lot of people live in Utah? I mean, it's a beautiful, stunning place. And there's activities, an endless list to participate in. So, even if you're asking me at a personal level, what excited me is I've got a laundry list of things to do with our family and kids, and I'm certainly sure that many people that move out here are drawn to that. I hope certainly that we're able to grab even more talent as our team grows, just simply from what the amenities are of the community. So that definitely brought us, and I think also the Silicon Slopes portion of Utah. I mean, you're seeing tech businesses migrate and set up either their headquarters or regional offices from a number of businesses, you know, as we speak. And you can see that, I always say, as you drive down the main interstate, you can see the logos up and down the buildings and tell that that's clearly the case.
And how big is your team now, and how big do you think you'll be in 3 to 5 years as far as employees?
I mean, gosh, our team is literally growing every week. You can check out our careers page. We've got a number of open roles as we continue to expand. And frankly, I think our team will be double or triple the size by the end of the year. Certainly no lack of growth and no lack of need as we drop into the market. I mean, keep in mind, products are shipping now and going out into the market. And so we've hit our full stride. We've hit launch. I would say we'll probably be triple the size just by the end of this calendar year.
And do I understand correctly? Last week we had on a manager from Kiln, which was an office sharing facility. Are you guys actually using one of their facilities as well?
We are. We're officing out of Kiln over in the Thanksgiving Point. I'm a huge fan. We've definitely enjoyed our time there. I mean, it's got a great vibe in the office, and it's really just a strong brand in the space of office sharing. So I'm a big supporter of that, and it's gone well for us.
And my last question is, how many of your employees commute to work on their e-bikes?
You know, I guess I've not thought of that. We have a number that commute in and out. I think our president and CEO lives fairly close. He's commuting in. I can say that we definitely commute regularly for lunchtime and just kind of jaunt to go out and grab something in the middle of the day and do everything we can to simply use exactly what we're putting out in the market, right? There's trail systems right along the highway and plenty of bike lanes in the area, and it certainly makes you feel safe deciding if you want to use a bike for transportation needs. So I hope to be one of those myself.
Yeah, Brandon, that probably wasn't a fair question this time of year, because it probably wouldn't have been very pleasant a couple of months ago. But with that, we've been talking to Brandon Proctor from the Serial One Cycle Company, a company that was formed originally out of a partnership with Harley-Davidson. Thanks to you for joining us today, Brandon.
Joining us now by phone is Park City High graduate Stephanie Reese. Like many of us listening this morning, Stephanie had a chance encounter with dolphins one morning while on a family vacation. In her case, she was 8 years old, and the dolphins were gracefully swimming past her family's Airbnb on the New Jersey shore. Unlike most of us, however, this chance encounter changed the tack of Stephanie's academic career and ultimately led to her becoming a field scientist with a group known as the Ocean Initiative. Join us now to hear how Stephanie pursued her passion and landed her dream job. Stephanie, thank you for joining us on Mound Money.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's start off. You wrote a blog post that really moved me, which is why I reached out to see if you'd be a guest, about just following your passion. You know, we're coming up on graduation season here. A lot of people tell young graduates, follow your heart, it'll work out. But in the back of our minds, we're saying, follow your heart, but make sure you study in an area that you can get a job. How did you think about balancing that passion with the ability to get a job after graduation from college?
Yeah, so I think that one of the hardest parts about, you know, being a student in college is that, you know, you're trying to enjoy the atmosphere. You're trying to enjoy actually taking classes and learning and having all these new experiences. But at the same time, there is kind of that like overarching loom of, well, what do I do after this? Like, what is the job market going to look like for me? So I definitely had a lot of that internal sort of dialogue around what I was going to do once I graduated. But I tried to just focus on things that I found during my college studies that sort of motivated me to want to learn more. So I really focused on the learning aspect of it, you know, and what I was super interested in, what made me want to just tell everyone and talk about it for, you know, hours on end. And so that sort of led me to research with animals, but more particularly research with whales and killer whales. And then I think I got lucky in some aspects in terms of a job becoming available at a time when I was able to sort of give it my all, but also I was patient and I just kept my eyes sort of on the ball of this is something I really care about and I want to be a part of.
Were you able to actually do some direct research while an undergraduate that sort of fed into this?
Yeah, I actually was. I was part of a graduate lab studying dogs. So she was doing canine behavior. And so I was able to sort of just be there and help for the data collection and also do my own smaller project, which was really eye-opening for me in terms of the whole process from designing a study to collecting data, cleaning it, you know, trying to make some results out of it. And I also took some courses that were pretty oriented towards research and the research process. So there was one course where I was able to spend 30 hours observing gorillas in the local zoo, and I designed a study around behavior, and then I was able to, again, collect the data and present it to a community of people, including people at the zoo who take care of those animals. So it was pretty cool.
So Roger and I are both friends with your father, Russ, and I'm sure he's been an amazing dad. Talk to us about some of the advice that he gave you as you chose to pursue what many would classify as a less traveled path, maybe a riskier path as far as being able to get a job. What kind of advice did your family give you? You talked about internally how you process this. What was the advice that people at Park City High and your family were giving you? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think one of the biggest lessons that I learned growing up from my parents and from my dad in particular is that, you know, success is sort of what you make it out to be, you know? So especially in today's world, a lot of the time there's pressure to sort of get a job immediately or to be going into a field or a path that you've predetermined. But there's been a lot of support from the family aspect around just following what I'm passionate about and being able to sort of take the space, I guess, to know what I want to do in the long term. Because it was sort of growing up, a lot of family and friends assumed I would become a vet, which is something that still it amuses me because as much as I do love animals, I've never been very good with like the medical aspect, ironically, considering my dad's a doctor. But it was always about, well, if you're not going to do that, what other options are there that, you know, will allow you to keep that passion that you have for animals? So I think that was one of the biggest pieces of advice was just to sort of remain faithful that there was going to be something for me, you know?
Yeah, and that faith is so important, you know, that when my daughters were born, my wife and I sat down and we had four values that we talked about that we wanted to instill in our kids. And one of them was faith, and not necessarily faith in a religion, although that's for us personally, that's important as well. But faith that life is going to work out, to pursue your dreams, to pursue what you want to do. And life will, you know, life has a way of working out if you're hardworking, if you're smart, if you apply yourself. Although the stakes are high, you know, when you graduate high school and you go into college. And as you say, when you're in college, you're thinking about what comes next. And I think as a business show, it's so important that we talk about this topic because your life and how you feel about the passion that you feel would be quite a bit different if you had pursued a different route. Let's say you decided to become a vet, even though, yeah, you like animals, but the whole caring for the animals thing really wasn't your skill set. I think it's so important to think about your skill set and give it a go, give it a try. Jim Carrey tells a story. It turns out Jim Carrey claims his father's even funnier than he, Jim Carrey, the comedian. But his father went into accounting because he wanted to be able to provide for his family. It felt like a safe thing. And it turned out accounting was a horrible route for him, and he had troubles providing for his family. And so Jim Carrey's point is, you can fail at things that you hate. Why not give it a go and try things that you love? And that's one of the reasons that your blog post really spoke to me was, here's this young lady that really is pursuing her dream and is going after it with 100%. And I just really, really admire that. It's graduation season coming up for Park City High. What advice do you have for young people trying to decide, you know, there's a lot of pressure in Park City. You graduated from Park City High, trying to decide what path that they should pursue.
Yeah, I think the biggest piece of advice would just be to sort of have fun and let go of some of the pressure on yourself, you know, really focus on college as an experience to learn and to grow and to sort of understand, like we just talked about, what is that inner drive within you, you know, that you'll be able to give your all and just sort of go through life knowing that you're doing something that you love, you know, and that you have that faith that it will work out. So I think just enjoy the experience, you know, make yourself a little bit uncomfortable sometimes by not knowing maybe exactly what you're doing, but that's okay, you know, except that's sort of the nature of life. Sometimes we can't control everything. And if you really put yourself into your studies and into learning and exploring, I really don't think you can fail.
Awesome. Well, that's a great note for us to wrap with. We've been speaking with Stephanie Reese. She is a field scientist with Oceans Initiative. Stephanie, thank you for joining us. We want to thank the great sponsors for our show. We couldn't do programs like this without our sponsors, and they include Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
And we want to thank our fabulous guests. First, we had Kevin Eikenberry and Wayne Turmel, authors of The Long Distance Teammate, Stay Engaged and Connected While Working Anywhere. Our last guest was Stephanie Reese, and we also had Brandon Proctor of the Serial One Cycle Company, who talked about Serial One's new partnership with Harley-Davidson. It left me with some really strange images of guys driving up in hogs, wandering through a Harley-Davidson and saying, what's this?
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.